You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Michael Chabon is one of America's most celebrated novelists, and his blend of humor, realism, and whimsy has earned him numerous awards, including the Pulitzer Prize for The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which brought him to the show in the past. His latest is Telegraph Avenue, his first in 5 years. It's set in a neighborhood in Oakland, California, and deals with race and class and how change and progress threaten to devour small business, the community, and the livelihood of its main characters. It's published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased that it brings Michael Chabon back to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. It's always good to be here.
Now, this book is set in 2004. Why that specific year?
Well, the principal threat that two of my principal characters are facing, the characters of Nat Jaffe and Archie Stallings, who are co-owners of a small, well-curated used vinyl record shop in Oakland, California, is the imminent arrival of a giant mega mini mall called a Dogpile Fang that is going to have a Cineplex and a bunch of retail places, and there's going to be a Dogpile store, which is, in the book, is a kind of combination of what's sort of like a Virgin megastore, but with an African-American focus in the products that they sell. And it's going to include a used vinyl store. And based on their experience of the similar store down in Los Angeles, it's going to be a very good used vinyl store, one that is probably going to put them out of business. And so in order to make this threat feel real and credible, I had to go a little bit back in time, because I think one of the dramatic ironies of the book is that the nominal villain of the piece, the retired NFL quarterback Gibson Good, who's the mogul behind the Dogpile stores, doesn't know what we as readers know, which is that he himself is facing imminent extinction. A huge wave of digital downloads and internet retail is about to flatten him as well.
And there are very few record stores anymore.
Right.
Well, the vinyl stores still hang on, partly because they are almost an anomaly in that world.
And they sell something that people still want, and yet nobody else is selling. But I felt like I needed to set the book in the last possible historical moment when such a thing would seem terrifying.
But this is the same sort of thing as the way small businesses react when a Walmart is coming into the area.
Right. I mean, it's a familiar experience. It's repeated across many different kinds of retail markets. And I've, since the book has come out, and when the independent booksellers first got their hands on copies and were reading it, a lot of what I heard was that they identified very strongly with the characters of Archie and Nat.
Their business is in a neighborhood called Broker. Is Broker based on a real neighborhood?
Brooklyn.
Brooklyn.
Yes.
Is there such a place?
Well, I invented the term to describe a place that I feel exists, which is the overlapping borderlands of Berkeley and Oakland, California. You know, people who live on one side or the other of the Oakland-Berkeley line spend a lot of their time and money on the opposite side of that line. And it just feels to me like a kind of unified district that doesn't have a name. So I decided to invent one, and I just made a portmanteau and pushed Brooklyn.
Well, would the fact that this book takes place in Oakland have particular significance for someone who lives in the Bay Area? It's not San Francisco. It's not Berkeley.
Well, you know, Oakland is definitely, I'd say, sort of the least well-known of those three. I mean, everyone has an image of San Francisco, and many people have an image of Berkeley, even if they've never been there. Oakland, you know, what is known chiefly outside of the Bay Area for the Raiders, I suppose, or for occasional reports of various kinds of violence or disturbances that occurred there.
Well, I would think that in the old days, before 2004, San Francisco was be sure to wear a flower in your hair. Berkeley was the student activist.
Right.
And Oakland was where the Black Panthers were.
Right. And Oakland and the Black Panthers story does play its part in the story that I'm telling here, no doubt. But, you know, the fact of the matter is Oakland is a great city. It has always suffered from the disadvantage of being across the bay from its more glamorous sister, San Francisco. But anybody who knows Oakland, who's lived in Oakland, knows what a congenial and what a remarkably diverse place it is.
But how did it come to be a city with a unique population?
Well,
it's, Los Angeles, we understand a lot of people moved to Los Angeles from all over the country,
right.
Especially during World War II,
right.
to get jobs.
Right. And the same thing happened in Oakland as well. In fact, it was very similar in many respects, in terms of some of the industries that people went to work in. Oakland is known for Kaiser Steel, Kaiser Automobiles. The Great Migration, whose sort of latter-day leg was a Western movement of African-American people, definitely had a terminus in Oakland. And in fact, speaking of terminuses, the Pullman Porters, the Western headquarters of the Pullman Porters was in Oakland, California. And so you had a lot of people settling in Oakland who were Pullman Porters, and their families and the descendants of Pullman Porters, you know, still live in Oakland today. It was a big rail terminus, and it was a big target of settlement for black people all over the country.
Now, this book is also about gentrification, not just the building of this huge megastore, but gentrification in general. And there's a feeling that sometimes progress can be a bad thing.
Yeah. I certainly didn't think of this book as being about gentrification when I was writing it. I really thought of it as being about my characters and their relationships and what they were going through. And
but they're all threatened with changes, and their wives are as well.
Yes, but the change in the neighborhood that they're confronting is the imminent arrival of this dogpile store. I actually tried to sort of invert the expectation in that this store is designed to attract and employ and create a new sort of retail downtown area in this neighborhood that lost its commercial heart during the period of urban renewal. And a huge freeway was constructed that ripped the heart, as so many other cities across the country, you know, when they decided to put the freeway in, they put it right through the heart of a really vibrant, historically black neighborhood. And so there's a social motive behind Gibson Goods deciding to do this and in the neighborhood that he chooses to do it in that makes the picture, I think, a little more ambiguous, because the gentrifier is himself a black man, and the improvement that's being contemplated is designed to improve the lot and the life quality of, you know, minority residents of this area. And the guy who's taking it the hardest and the one who feels the most personally affronted is a white guy.
Hmm. You mean Nat?
Nat Jaffe, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who's the partner of
yes.
Archie.
Yes. And he's all up in arms, and he organizes protest meetings and in this weird way, then the people who are protesting this gentrification, when the people show up for the meeting, much to Nat's chagrin, most of them are white people. And so, everything's a little bit inverted, I think, you know, because I don't see the picture as being quite as stark or quite as clear as it's often made out to be.
My guest is Michael Chabon, whose latest novel is Telegraph Avenue. And it's interesting that the cover is designed to look like an old vinyl record with tracks on it.
Yeah.
Dream of Cream, The Church of Vinyl, A Bird of Wide Experience, Return to Forever, Brokeland. So these are references that are important.
Those are the titles of the parts of the novel. The book doesn't have chapters. It just has parts and or named chapters, I should say. So, and I guess since there were only five of them, it seemed like the perfect number to put on the listings of a purported record label.
I mentioned Archie and Nat are both married. Their wives, Gwen and Aviva, are facing similar problems in a way. Why is their business threatened?
Their business is threatened. Their business is under constant threat because they are nurse midwives in practice together. And even though they are incredibly competent, successful nurse midwives who've, you know, never lost a baby, and have left, you know, more than 1,000 women happy and healthy, they are always on the bubble because the medical establishment, and more in particular the insurance establishment, views what they do as somehow, if not suspect, then less than full medical care. They have privileges at a local hospital to deliver babies at that hospital. And they also like to do home births, and that status of trying to do home births but also being able to deliver babies at the hospital is always under threat. And in fact, in actuality, I don't. There aren't any more nurse midwives in the entire East Bay Area who are allowed to do that. If you do home births, you're not allowed to assist it or attend births at hospitals anymore. So their status, their privileges are always under threat. And this is a situation that is aggravated in the opening pages of the novel when a birth goes wrong through no fault of either midwives. It's just one of those things that happens. And they actually deal with the birth properly, and the outcome is, in the end, is all right. But as hospital establishment sort of seizes on this as an excuse to finally take away the privileges that they've been or wanting to take away for a long time.
Well, in your characters, the men are in the record business, which is being made kind of obsolete
right.
in the digital age.
Right.
And the midwives are becoming obsolete because we now see them as being old-fashioned
right,
in their
right,
approach.
Right.
I mean, this is almost like the same fight we have over raw milk cheeses. You
right,
know?
Right.
And there are so many other things where things worked perfectly well before, and yet we say that they're no good anymore.
Right. This is a book that takes an interest in a lot of different sort of quote-unquote outmoded technologies or ways of being. From midwifery, vinyl records, there's a Zeppelin in the book. The title itself, Telegraph Avenue, refers to a technology that has been superseded. You know, there's a fascination with abandoned or outmoded ways of living, ways of being that permeates the book. You know, in the case of both vinyl records and midwifery, I would say they both meet the criteria that you're suggesting of actually still being valid and in many ways unimprovable and yet having been left behind.
There are some people who still prefer vinyl records.
I'm one of them.
The sound is best.
I am one of them.
So do you have, do you listen to jazz?
I do. I listen to, you know, all kinds of music on vinyl still, classical, jazz, rock and roll. I have a small collection. I'm not a big record collector, although I mean, I may get there eventually, but I do listen to music while I work. I have for a long time now. And what I've recently in the past few years discovered is that if you listen to records while you work, then you're obliged to get up every 20 minutes and turn the record over or put a new record on, which is what is the recommended period of time that you stay at your keyboard working before you take a break.
You can really screw things up if you get a record changer. But
exactly.
So do these books have soundtracks in your head?
They often do, at least since The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which I wrote while listening heavily to big band swing, Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Lionel Hampton. I also listened to a lot of Benny Goodman quartets and trios while I was working on that book. And, you know, that is the soundtrack to that book.
No wonder it won a Pulitzer Prize. That's such good jazz backing.
Yeah, and that was really the first book in which I began listening to sort of try to program the music I worked to suit what I was working on. With this book, it was jazz again, very heavily, but this time it was different jazz. It was the soul jazz and jazz funk of the 60s and 70s.
Now, you bring in all sorts of other people, fictional and non and real.
Mm-hmm.
Are you suggesting that you work in a kind of a universe where everything exists at the same time? Barack Obama makes an appearance.
Right, that's right.
Book.
Well, I mean, you know, but the Barack Obama who makes an appearance in my book is, of course, a character. I was very interested when I was reading Michael Lewis's that wonderful piece he has in Vanity Fair right now. In which now I can't remember if it's Obama or Lewis who describes Obama as a character, that the Obama we know is a character. And so what I you know, a lot of people refer to this as a cameo appearance, but to me it was more of a nature of a crossover, that a character from another work of fiction was making an appearance in my work of fiction.
Although in this case he is this is before he becomes a senator. He is
yes,
still
he's a state senator, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's running for Senate. It's August 2004. He's just off his first star turn at the Democratic Convention that year where he gave that amazing speech that so many of us remember so vividly. And he is just beginning to attract attention when he makes his appearance in my novel.
Don't you think all people in the public eye are to some degree inventions? You have to invent a persona.
Absolutely.
That you present to the world.
Absolutely.
You say all the snarky things to your closest, your intimates, but and then you you come across as the sweetest person in the world, or vice versa.
Right, or unless your persona is to say snarky things. And that was what emboldened me to incorporate the character of Barack Obama into my novel. I don't know the man, and very few of us do, but we all know the character, and we know the story. We know the narrative. We've been following it for 6 to 8 years now on the national stage. And, that was what I was working with. I mean, I suppose you could draw that there's a parrot in my novel who is the same parrot who makes an appearance in another book I wrote called The Final Solution, which also contains a parrot and is about a very elderly Sherlock Holmes living in retirement in Sussex in 1944. So I suppose you could, use that sort of St. Elsewhere principle of connecting fictional characters and say that Sherlock Holmes and Barack Obama now exist in the same fictional universe.
Well, they do on television. Sherlock Holmes is now in New York.
Right, I saw that.
An Asian woman as Dr. Watson.
Of course, I've been loving the BBC one with Benedict Cumberbatch.
Now, it's been 5 years since the Yiddish Policeman's Union was published. Have you been working on this book all that time?
Essentially, yeah. I started work on it shortly after finishing Yiddish Policeman's Union. It was about 5 years altogether.
You have the parrot do a 4,000-word sentence.
Yes.
Is
he doesn't
fun?
Speak a 4,000-word sentence, but he is the protagonist of a 4,000-word sentence that is the third part of this book. Yeah. It was fun.
When you started, did you know you were going to write such a long sentence?
I wanted to write the verbal equivalent of a tracking shot in a movie, a shot that moves through potentially a large number of scenes and settings without a cut in a single take. And I wanted to try to get the equivalent of that in the middle of this book because I wanted to check in on all of my characters sort of simultaneously, or as close to simultaneously as I could, given the fact that language is sequential. And I didn't know how long it was going to be, but I knew it had to be as long as it took to be able to check in on all of those characters. And it ended up being about 4,000 words. But I felt that it was also echoing, hopefully, and suggesting the groove on a record album, which is, you think of it as being 10 songs or 6 songs or whatever, and they look distinct if you look at the surface of the record, but it is actually just one long inward spiraling groove.
How much is the writing process for you a matter of giving yourself challenges? I mean, that's a real challenge.
Entirely, and I think would be one way of answering that
A way
question.
To keep yourself involved with each new book?
Yes.
Because it must be pretty easy once you have a book like Cavalier and Clay to just say, okay, I'll do something like that again. It was a great success. I won a Pulitzer Prize. Mm-hmm. I sold a lot of books.
Uh-huh. I can't imagine thinking that way, and I don't, part of what appeals to me in taking on the project of a book is the degree of challenge it seems to present. So in this, I knew from the beginning in writing this book, I was going to be putting myself into the point of view of African-American characters, an African-American woman, furthermore, a pregnant African-American woman who was going to give birth in the course of the story. Right away, I could feel that was not going to be easy, and that was what appealed to me in doing it. But even Leonard on a sentence basis, just each sentence for me presents a particular challenge. It's a problem to be solved, and not in a negative way, in the sense of like a puzzle, a crossword puzzle. There's a intellectual satisfaction that comes from just getting the sentence just right.
Especially when it's 4,000 words long.
Yes.
Michael Chabon's latest book is a novel called Telegraph Avenue. It is published by Harper. I'm assuming you're already at work on another book?
No, I'm taking a little break. I'm working on a TV series for HBO with my wife, Ayel Waldman. We're trying to develop this series there, and I'm working on a script for that. And then I'm toying with a number of different ideas.
Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.